Committee endorses it. The Global Times report said that as the host country, China has no plans to invite politicians who hyped the boycott of the Beijing Games. It noted wryly that President Biden's talks of a boycott was nothing but self-deception. In an indirect reference to the pandemic conditions in the United States, Global Times observed, "Given the grave situation of the COVID-19 pandemic globally, it is not proper to invite foreign guests on a large scale, which can be easily understood by people with common sense." The snub comes hardly 2 weeks after Joe Biden's virtual meeting on 15th of November with Xi Jinping. Though in a larger perspective, this extraordinary episode falls into place given the provocative manner in which the Biden administration has been taunting Beijing by transgressing over China's core interests lately. On the other hand, Xi Jinping's exceptional gesture towards Vladimir Putin by personally conveying the invitation to the Games in a phone call in August bears testimony to the high quality of the two countries' comprehensive strategic partnership of coordination for a new era. Lengthy commentary on the topic on Tuesday, 30th of November, pinned on the regular bilateral consultation between the heads of governments of China and Russia that day, Global Times singled out the rapidly expanding and deepening ties between the two countries' armed forces. It pointedly noted, on military cooperation, the two countries recently signed a roadmap for closer ties, which according to military experts indicates that Russia and China have common interests and views on strategic stability and regional security, especially in the Pacific region. Experts say such enhancement of cooperation in the defense sector is also viewed as a reaction to the West's pressure on Russia and to the threats that China received from the United States and its allies. Experts add, Wu Qian, spokesperson for the Ministry of National Defense, said at a press conference on Thursday, 25th of November, that the Chinese military expects an even better relationship with its Russian counterpart and is willing to play a bigger role with it in safeguarding world peace and stability. The above two reports in Global Times appeared on a day when the Kremlin signaled that Russia-China strategic relations are poised for a historic leap. In separate remarks on Tuesday, 30th of November, President Vladimir Putin and Russian Prime Minister Mikhail Mishustin beckoned Moscow's willingness for a de facto alliance with Beijing. President Putin positively evaluated China's growing defense potential as it enjoys the highest level of relations with the country and is itself ramping up its armed forces. In his characteristic nuanced way, Vladimir Putin drew a loaded comparison with the existing alliance among the United States, Britain, and France. Again, during the recent consultations, Russian Prime Minister Mikhail Mishustin proposed to Chinese Premier Li Keqiang that in the prevailing complex external environment of sanctions, unfriendly actions, unfair competition, and illegitimate unilateral sanctions, as well as political and economic pressure, Russia and China should also team up for their joint development. Mikhail Mishustin pointed at an intertwining of plans between the Moscow-led Eurasian Economic Union and China's Belt and Road Initiative, while also reiterated that President Putin had earlier presented this idea. Mikhail Mishustin told Li Keqiang, "This is important for bolstering the interconnection in Eurasian space. It will help guarantee the economic progress of Russia and China and create a solid foundation for the formation of a greater Eurasian partnership. To be sure, Putin's planned visit to Beijing in February holds the promise of a profound elevation of the Sino-Russian partnership from its already high level. A transition is underway from the close cooperation between the two powers to coordination and active pooling of resources to support each other, not only for safeguarding their core interests in the face of the growing belligerence in the Biden administration's strategies, but also at a global level to build a network of regional alliances. The Pentagon's 2021 Global Posture Review, which was announced on Monday, 29th of November, signals a global posture and intention to develop a global response capability that not only embraces the Indo-Pacific region and Europe, but also includes enduring posture requirements in West Asia, Africa, and Latin America. This is a far cry from the pacifist agenda Joe Biden had previously espoused, and his loud claim at the very inception of his presidency that diplomacy is back at the center of U.S. foreign policy. Significantly, President Putin's remarks on Tuesday, 30th of November, also touched on third-country cooperation between Russia and China as a major vector of their partnership. President Putin said, "We have many fields of cooperation with China. One of them concerns our work in third countries. It is well underway, but it may be expanded further. Why? Because we share roughly the same approaches and the same principles." President Putin stressed that Moscow supported Beijing's efforts to create a global infrastructure of trade routes. He said, "We support our Chinese friends' efforts based on the One Belt, One Road strategy." Interestingly, President Vladimir Putin singled out West Asia as potentially a theater of Russia-China coordination. Indeed, he spoke in this vein, as the Sino-Russian coordination has shifted to a common stance, robustly endorsing the Iranian demand for the lifting of U.S. sanctions and the Vienna negotiations getting off to a promising start. The bottom line is that by any reckoning of diplomatic practice, the co-authorship of a powerful opinion piece in an influential U.S. magazine recently by the Russian and Chinese ambassadors in Washington, Anatoly Antonov and King Gang, lambasting Joe Biden's summit of democracy, proclaims that the Sino-Russian alliance is already sailing on the Potomac River.
Communique.
In 2009, David Mendoza Herarte was extradited from Spain to the United States on condition he be allowed to serve his sentence in Spain. I have obtained classified documents which show the diplomatic assurances given by the U.S. Embassy in Madrid to Spain and how the United States violated the conditions of his extradition. Court documents sent to me show how the United States denied his transfer application numerous times. Mendoza spent over 6 years in the United States fighting to get back to Spain. While in prison, Mendoza sued both the United States and Spain for failing to uphold the conditions of his extradition and violating his human rights. His case is so extraordinary and such a miscarriage of justice that it was recently taken up by the United Nations. In October, Mendoza's case was mentioned in the English High Court, where the United States is now trying to extradite Julian Assange to the U.S. The United States has offered very similar diplomatic assurances, saying that Assange can serve his sentence in his home country, Australia. Assange's lawyers cited Mendoza's case as proof that these diplomatic assurances from the United States cannot be trusted. James Lewis, the lead U.S. prosecutor, told the High Court that, quote, "The United States has never broken a diplomatic assurance." Will these documents These classified diplomatic communications and court documents paint a completely different picture. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. David Mendoza Herarte was born and raised in the United States, but he described Spain to me as his second home. He is both an American and Spanish citizen. Mendoza was wanted by the United States for drug trafficking in the early 2000s, moving marijuana between Canada, across the border into Seattle. Mendoza first realized that U.S. authorities were onto him when he found a GPS tracker stuck on the bottom of his car. He told me that teams were put on him to survey him 24 hours a day, with federal agents even renting a house across the street from him. Mendoza dropped everything and decided to leave the United States for Mexico to stay at some property that he owned there. When he learned that there was a warrant out for his arrest, he moved to the Spanish capital, Madrid, in June 2006. 2 years later, in June 2008, the Spanish authorities arrested Mendoza under an international arrest warrant. The United States had requested his extradition on drug-related and money laundering charges. At this point, Mendoza had already settled in Spain and started a family. He was married and had one child with another on the way, both Spanish nationals. This is important because in Spain, if you go to jail, the government can't just put you in a facility that is so far away that it would prevent your family or make it practically impossible for them to see you. This is the right to private and family life under Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights. Now, in August 2008, the Spanish National Court ruled that Mendoza's extradition to the United States could only go ahead under three conditions. Number one, that he serve any sentence in Spain, so he would be close to his family. Number two, no life sentence could be handed down. Number three, that he would not be tried for currency structuring. Spanish judges made two very clear rulings on this in August and November 2008. If the United States wanted to extradite David Mendoza, it had to send him back to Spain to serve his sentence. In January 2009, the United States Embassy in Madrid sent this. This is the classified diplomatic assurance given to Spain regarding Mendoza. The diplomatic assurance was worrying because it did not specifically state that Mendoza would be sent to Spain to serve his sentence. It only said that the United States, quote, does not object to Mendoza making an application to serve his sentence in Spain, something that the United States cannot do anyway because every prisoner has the right to apply for a treaty transfer anyway. A few months ago, in July 2021, the United States offered very similar diplomatic assurances to the United Kingdom so they could extradite Julian Assange. They said that Assange could serve a sentence in his home country, Australia. Now, here's the issue. It's not enough for the United States to say that it will let Assange go to Australia. Australia also has to consent to the transfer. Otherwise, it's meaningless. And I can tell you, as one of the only journalists covering Assange's extradition, Australia has said nothing about taking Assange. Now, in Mendoza's case, the United States diplomatic assurances to Spain were very ambiguous and vaguely worded. However, this next document, signed by the United States Embassy in Madrid, was certainly not. This document is called the Acta de Entrega, or Deed of Surrender. And what it says is very clear. The Acta de Entrega states that Mendoza was surrendered to U.S. authorities, and more importantly, it confirms that he was handed over, quote, in accordance with what was previously stipulated by Section 2 of the National Criminal Court. This means whoever signs this document agrees to the terms and conditions given by the Spanish court. They agree that Mendoza must serve his sentence in Spain. And who signed this document? The United States Embassy, David Mendoza, and Spain. On April 30th, 2009, David Mendoza Herarte was extradited to the United States right after signing this Acta de Entrega. Prosecutors threatened Mendoza with over 20 years in prison if he didn't hand over more of his property. The U.S. government had already taken $14 million worth of assets and properties from Mendoza, with most of them having nothing to do with narcotics or anything illicit. Mendoza was later sentenced and given 14 years in prison. He asked the court to respect the conditions of his extradition and send him back to Spain so he could carry out his sentence, as agreed. But it now became clear that the United States had no intention of sending Mendoza back to Spain. They had squeezed him for every last penny and then violated the diplomatic assurances given to Spain. I spoke with Damon Mendoza. I asked him about his sentencing and how he found out that the United States never planned on actually sending him to Spain.
When I started getting a smell, a whiff, that they weren't going to comply with any of this, was when he asked me, because I said, Your Honor, there's some conditions that I want the court to recognize in respect of why Spain sent me, extradited me to the United States that are required of the extradition. And he looked at me and he put his glasses down and he said, young man, he said, and I said, one of those conditions were I am to serve my sentence in Spain, as promised. And he said, young man, he said, are you familiar with the international instrument that has brought you to the United States? I said, yes. Do you know the name of that instrument? I said, yeah, it's the Spanish-U.S. extradition treaty. And he said, correct. He said, can I ask you another question? I said, obviously, you're the judge. He says, are you signatory on that? And I said, signatory? I said, obviously not. It's done by my government. Yours is done by your government, but it applies to all of us. He said, it does apply, but if you're not signatory, you don't have a right to claim. Meaning my government would have to make a claim against non-compliance of the treaty or the conditions that were applied within that treaty, not me. So right then I knew this is not looking good.
What the United States was essentially saying here is that Mendoza, his signature is not on the extradition treaty, so he can't make any claims, which is ridiculous because the extradition treaties in general are signed between countries, between governments, not people. Nevertheless, this is the argument that they made. Mendoza is certain that the United States government will play this exact same trick on Julian Assange. Assange will get to the United States. They might block his transfer to Australia or place him in oppressive prison conditions. And if he tries to contest this, they will say, hey, you didn't sign the extradition treaty. You have no claim. In Mendoza's case, however, there was a document that he, the United States, and Spain all signed together, which explicitly stated that he must serve his sentence in Spain, and it is the Acta de Entrega. All three signatures are right here. Now, Mendoza was given 14 years in prison. Instead of immediately sending him to Spain to carry out the sentence, he was told that he has to apply for a treaty transfer. He did. And the answer that he got from the United States was no.
I applied for a treaty transfer. They just told me, the embassy, I spoke to the Spanish embassy. It said, go ahead and just apply. You'll be back in a couple months to serve your sentence. I was sentenced to 14 years in federal prison for possession and distribution of marijuana. So I said, okay, let me apply to go back to Spain. So I applied, I think it was November 2009. It was towards the tail end of 2009 because they wouldn't allow me to apply there at the detention center. They said, oh no, we have to process you into prison. And I could see this was just a game play. So I said, screw it. I called up the embassy. I told them, listen, these guys are playing games. I need to apply and you need to help me make that application. They refused. They said, no, you have to do it through your case manager. So when I got to Colorado, they sent me to a medium high institution in Colorado. When I got to Colorado, I asked the case manager there who was assigned to me. I said, sir, there's some conditions. And he said, you can apply, but there's the United States is going to be told by anybody what to do. I said, all right. I mean, that's your position. There's to each their own. So I applied in 2009, and I was denied 6 months later in 2010. I think the summer, June or July 2010. So then I started saying, wait a minute here. You know, you guys took an extra piece of property from me. I've got a contract. You promised Spain. It's black and white. And that's what I knew. We're going to have some serious problems here.
In total, Mendoza applied three times to transfer to Spain. All three applications were denied, violating the extradition conditions. Once he applied, he had to wait 8 months for a decision and even longer to apply again. This is the document from the U.S. Department of Justice denying his transfer in 2010. It states, there is no administrative appeal from this decision. Unless otherwise noted above, the prisoner may reapply 2 years after this denial. When the United States denied Mendoza's transfer in 2010, he immediately sued Spain. He figured the United States is not going to give him any justice, so he needs to get justice in Spain. He wanted to pressure Spain to pressure the U.S. to enforce the extradition conditions. Mendoza sued Spain in the criminal court, the constitutional courts, but got nowhere. His last option was the civil court. So in 2014, Mendoza filed two lawsuits against Spain. Number one, that the conditions of his extradition had been violated. And number two, that his human rights had been violated. Each case went to the Spanish Supreme Court. Mendoza won both.
So when the Supreme Court ruling came out a couple weeks later, it said, I don't care what you do, you need, first of all, it said that they were in total disbelief. It shows you the control and intimidation the United States has on these people. They were in total disbelief that the Spanish authorities only sent out two diplomatic notes saying, oh, over now at this point, a 6-year period of time, oh, could you please send Dave Mendoza back? It's required.
Two notes.
Two diplomatic notes. They were in total disbelief. The Spanish Supreme Court said, that's unacceptable. And they basically told him, if you can't resolve this, we will resolve it. And then a few weeks later came out my human rights violations. My human rights were being violated. So the Supreme Court made it very clear to him in that order that said, if this lasts any longer, we will take the actions necessary. And I asked my attorney, what actions are those? And she told me, Dave, those actions are, they're the only ones who can suspend a treaty. The court can actually suspend the extradition treaty between Spain and the United States. She says, they don't want that to happen. This is your ticket home. They don't want that to happen because once they suspend the treaty, they can't cancel it, but they can suspend it because they say, well, it's not protecting the law and constitution of Spain. But when they suspend it, to reactivate that treaty, it has to go through the whole Congress and Parliament thing. And then it becomes highlighted, and then people start seeing it, and then the EU, other member states start seeing it. And these guys like to do things under the radar. And so that's when they said, we'll get them back.
At the same time Mendoza was suing Spain, there was also pressure coming from inside the country. Spanish judges didn't block, but stopped processing extraditions to the United States. They were basically telling the Americans, you better send Mendoza back if you want extraditions to the U.S. to continue.
So finally I wrote the Chief Justice. I wrote all the justices of the federal court, but I got a break when I wrote the Chief Justice. He wrote me back. He sent me a stack of documents. And he called in the U.S. Embassy personnel, I suspect Kimberly Weiss and company, and said, you're going to make this guy come back, because if not, we're going to cut your extraditions. As of this point, extraditions have been very fluid and very fructiferous, as he puts it, for the American authorities. They promised him, oh yeah, don't worry, Mendoza will be back by the summer. That ruling was September 2011. They said I'd be back in Spain by 2012. They promised him that. No, didn't work. And so what they did, the Spanish judges, they have no authority to cancel or suspend any extradition treaty, but they were able to not process them. Like, you have a stack of extradition requests, we're going to put the Americans have on the bottom. That was pissing off the United States. So there was a lot of diplomatic communications going back. How can we get this resolved? Blah, blah, blah.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
So at this point, Mendoza was suing Spain at the Supreme Court, and he was also suing the United States in civil court. He was suing Obama's Attorney General, Eric Holder. And the United States came and told Mendoza, if he drops the lawsuit in the U.S., they'll let him go home. In the end, Mendoza reluctantly accepted, but he told me that dropping this suit was the biggest regret of his life.
In 2000 to 2012 or 13, whenever they changed the law, was a 6-year maximum sentence. Now remember, the acts of my crime were in 2006 and before, supposedly. I was sentenced in 2009. I requested to go back to Spain in 2009, which was denied. If they would have sent me back to Spain, I would have been back in Spain, which the Supreme Court said, yes, he should have been back in Spain in 2009 when he requested. That's what the condition was. There was no new law then in Spain. When I get back to Spain, this judge, who's now the Minister of Interior, I don't know what the hell, he's one of these neoliberals here in Spain. This judge basically says, no. Well, first he told my attorney, yes, don't worry, Dave's going to get out. 3 days later, my attorney comes visit me in prison in Spain and says, I got bad news for you. I had a second discussion, communication with him, and he says, he's not letting you out. Somebody touched him. I said, what do you mean somebody touched him? He said, somebody told him that ain't happening. I have no doubt it was Miss Kimberly Weiss, you know, and I suspect what she did was the Americans are pissed. I want you to know that we don't want Mendoza out.
When Spain conditioned Mendoza's extradition, when it said that he must serve his sentence in Spain, it imposed this condition in order to protect the nucleus of the family. That's the whole point. And in the end, the United States succeeded in violating the whole essence of this requirement. Mendoza's family and relationships suffered tremendously from his extradition and the fact that the United States kept him there for almost 7 years, violating the requirements of the Spanish court.
2 years in my sentence, my wife divorced me. Understood why. You know, I said, it's got a 14-year sentence. Doesn't look good here. So she divorced me. You know, I didn't hold that against her. I understood it. Everything that the court, Spanish court, attempted to establish on that condition, the United States successfully destroyed. And why, I'm not quite sure even yet, but they did. You know, you and I have had discussions as to maybe why, but then we'll get into that. But they destroyed. My two little boys, who are now 12 and 13, don't call me Dad. They call me David. My mother and father passed away while I was in prison. It is what it is. You know, and I know there's people out there, well, you got yourself in that position, you got to swallow it. Yeah, but that doesn't allow you to break the law. That doesn't allow you to break the law.
In 2013, a French court blocked the extradition of Michael and Linda Mastro to the U.S., citing Mendoza's case as proof that France could not trust assurances from the United States. Mendoza has helped many others fighting extraditions in the U.S., and he hopes that his case will also help Julian Assange. Assange faces up to 175 years in a U.S. prison for publishing evidence of U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. The United States has offered assurances that it won't place Assange in special administrative measures, or SAMs, which are known as the worst prison conditions, complete isolation. The U.S. also said that Assange could serve a potential sentence in Australia, in his home country.
They said they would consent to Julian Assange's transfer to Australia. But let me show you something here. And I'm as familiar with this as most anybody. This is a treaty, the Convention of Strasbourg, to allow prisoners to transfer from one country to another. Okay? This is the international instrument that allows that to take place. They made very clear that, oh yeah, they have no problems. They will allow him to be transferred to Australia. I can tell you what they're going to do. The treaty obligates all parties must agree to the transfer. That means, okay, the United States have given their consent. Obviously, Julian Assange will say yes. But we have no assurances that the Aussies will say yes. They're one of the Five Eyes. I can tell you they're going to probably say, uh-uh. Just like that has happened on not one, I'm telling you, all the inmates in federal prison, well, not all of them, but the ones in Fort Dix would come to me that had extradition issues because they saw me as the go-to guy. And they would say, how can we force this? And you know what the United States would say? It's not us. We've given the consent. What they would do is the United States has these backdoor communications with the Canadian government. At that time, Harper was involved, who was a conservative. Don't ask for the transfer. Sorry. Not asking for your transfer. It's not us. We've complied with the document. So for that to have any weight, the most minimal weight, and they're going to try and screw him anyway, the Aussies need to say, we agree to that too. They need to send a diplomatic note.
When it comes to Julian Assange, Mendoza made something very clear. Diplomatic assurances like this need to be signed by all three parties. That means the US, the UK, and Julian Assange. Okay? Because if either party refuses to comply, Assange can go and contest that in a United States court, despite him not being a signatory of the extradition treaty. Because the first thing the US will say is, well, you did not sign the extradition treaty between the US and the UK. You don't have any claim. But if there is a contract with all three signatures, Assange does have a claim. Now, regarding Assange carrying out a sentence in Australia, the United States needs to explicitly say in the diplomatic note that it consents to his transfer. But that's not everything, as Mendoza explains.
And then within that diplomatic note, it should say Julian Assange has a right to contest any of these conditions if they are not applied correctly or if one of the parties find non-application. Okay, not just Julian Assange, the U.S. government, or give the right to all of them. But they all three need to have that right to contest those documents. I'm a nobody. And they went to the extent of this to do it to a nobody. Can you imagine what they're going to do to, I mean, if all these promises that they're making for Julian, or making to the court on behalf of Julian, do you think they're, I mean, I'm a nobody. And not just that, if he doesn't have a signed contract that he's signatory of, and that specifically stipulates that he can sue the Americans as equally as the Brits for not compliance of this.
The lead prosecutor in Assange's case said that the United States has never, ever broken a diplomatic assurance. Well, that's simply not true. These documents show very clearly the United States broke its diplomatic assurances to Spain. The agreement to send Mendoza to Spain to serve his sentence was violated. This is undeniable. Only after suing both the United States and Spain, his own countries, was Mendoza allowed to return. Only after Spain's Supreme Court threatened to suspend the extradition treaty did the Americans finally allow Mendoza to go back. Mendoza had the Spanish Supreme Court, senior Spanish judges, and the Spanish public on his side. Assange does not. Assange is neither American nor British. In the event the U.S. violates its diplomatic assurances, which is practically guaranteed, Assange has no one to fight on his behalf, not even the Australian government. And given the special relationship between the U.S. and Britain, the idea that Britain would force the U.S. to abide by the extradition conditions is simply unrealistic. If the United States gives assurances to the United Kingdom in order to extradite Julian Assange, these assurances must be worded very explicitly and signed by all parties, including Assange, so that he may contest any noncompliance in court on his own behalf. When it comes to diplomatic assurances from the United States, it's not a question of, are these assurances enough? It's a question of, can these assurances be enforced once Julian Assange is in the United States? This is what the judges in the English High Court must ask themselves. While they still have the power to stop the United States from criminalizing journalism and violating Assange's human rights. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
After the U.S. government announced that it has reached an agreement with Mexico to restart the Trump-era Remain in Mexico program, immigrant rights advocates criticized the Biden administration for hiding behind the flood court order to justify reviving a policy that forces asylum seekers to wait in makeshift camps along the southern border pending legal review of their cases. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Kenny Stencil, journalist. This article is published under the heading Biden Rebuked for Plan to Implement Even Worse Version of Trump's Remain in Mexico Policy. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. After the U.S. government announced recently that it has reached an agreement with Mexico to restart the Trump-era Remain in Mexico program, immigrant rights advocates criticized the Biden administration for hiding behind a flawed court order to justify reviving a policy that forces asylum seekers to wait in makeshift camps along the southern border pending legal review of their cases. Re-implementation of the so-called Migrant Protection Protocols MPP program will begin soon, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, DHS, said in a statement, adding that once fully operational, MPP enrollments will take place across the southwest border and returns to Mexico will take place at 7 ports of entry in San Diego, Calexico, Nogales, El Paso, Eagles Pass, Laredo, and Brownsville. Mexico's decision to accept the return of individuals enrolled in the program is subject to certain humanitarian improvements, DHS noted, according to the agency, which worked with the U.S. Departments of State and Justice. Key changes to MPP include a commitment that proceedings will generally be concluded within 6 months of an individual's initial return to Mexico, opportunities for enrollees to secure access to and communicate with counsel before and during non-refoulement interviews and immigration court hearings, improved non-refoulement procedures, and an increase in the amount and quality of information enrolled individuals receive about MPP. DHS will exclude particularly vulnerable individuals from being enrolled in MPP. In addition, DHS will provide COVID-19 vaccinations for all persons enrolled in MPP. Immigrant rights advocates, however, stress that MPP is an irredeemable violation of human rights, regardless of the minor revisions proposed by the U.S. and Mexican governments. The Biden administration's shameful regression in restarting this unlawful Trump policy flies in the face of its own determination that no number of changes could render this deadly policy more humane or provide the cases to the asylum system that the law requires. Mariela Hincapi, executive director of the National Immigration Law Center, said in a statement recently. Aaron Rachlin Melnick, a former immigration attorney who is now policy counsel at the American Immigration Council, concurred. In a detailed Twitter thread, he said that allowing the tiny handful of people who managed to get lawyers, 5-7% compared to 60% inside the U.S., to have more meeting opportunities before hearings is not much of a help. In her statement, Hincapi said that since its creation, the Remain in Mexico policy has subjected tens of thousands of people to grave danger and violated their fundamental right to asylum in the United States. The Washington Post reported that officials in the U.S. are planning to initially use the MPP program primarily for single adult asylum seekers, who account for the majority of unauthorized border crossings, according to an unnamed Biden administration official. Mexico is willing to accept asylum seekers from Spanish-speaking countries, as with the previous version of the program, but migrants from all Western Hemisphere nations will be eligible for return, the newspaper reported, citing an administration official. In response, Rachel Melnick argued that the Biden administration's choice to expand Remain in Mexico to everyone from the Western Hemisphere, including Haitians, makes the program even broader than it was ever under the Trump administration. President Joe Biden didn't just bring back Remain in Mexico, he is made it worse. Legal experts, however, argue that the Biden administration has far more leeway than it claims and is certainly not required to expand the program. In response to a lawsuit filed by Republican officials in Texas and Missouri, a federal judge in August ordered the Biden administration to reinstate Remain in Mexico. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, which former President Donald Trump pushed in an even more conservative direction by appointing numerous far-right judges, refused the administration's request to put the ruling on hold and ordered expedited consideration of the administration's appeal, the Associated Press reported. On August 24th, AP noted, the U.S. Supreme Court's six right-wing justices argued that the Biden administration likely violated federal law in trying to end Remain in Mexico and refused to block the lower court's ruling. Nevertheless, as Rachlin Melnick pointed out, the lower court said Biden doesn't need to do the exact same implementation as Trump. Moreover, said No More Deaths, an organization that provides humanitarian aid to migrants in Sonoran borderlands, officials in the Biden administration were considering reinstating MPP well before the court gave them a convenient excuse to do so. Their hands aren't tied. This is a choice. No More Deaths cited reporting by Vice, published almost a week before the Supreme Court handed down its decision, which said senior U.S. officials have privately discussed reviving the Trump-era policy Migrant Protection Protocols, MPP, colloquially known as Remain in Mexico, in order to manage the number of migrants arriving at the border, according to three sources with knowledge of the discussions. Under the policy, the U.S. sent more than 70,000 asylum seekers from 2019 to 2021 to some of Mexico's most dangerous border cities to wait while their immigration cases were decided. Biden heavily criticized the policy as a candidate and suspended it on his first day in office. But as border apprehensions jumped, high-ranking officials in the White House floated the idea of bringing the program back, and it's been bandied about 4 weeks. Among a small circle of government officials, discussions have centered around whether there could be a gentler version of the policy, a notion immigration advocates decry as ludicrous. The NILC's Hanikpe recently stressed that the Biden administration must stop hiding behind a flawed court order to justify restarting Remain in Mexico.
Aperture.
Welcome back, everyone. In the first part, we saw how in 1951, inhabitants of a French village were suddenly tormented by terrifying hallucinations. At least 7 people died, dozens were taken to a local asylum, and hundreds were affected. Immediately, wild theories started emerging to explain this mysterious case of mass insanity. There were claims of poisoned flour, contaminated water, and even witchcraft. The truth was stranger than any of these theories. The Central Intelligence Agency had spiked the local food with LSD as part of a mind control experiment at the height of the Cold War. And with time, U.S. government's interest in LSD shifted from a defensive to an offensive orientation. While the initial experiments with LSD were fairly simple, if shockingly unethical, over time these LSD experiments grew increasingly elaborate. Stay with us as victims reveal the naked truth in the next part of this program.
Entire populations bore the consequence of large-scale tests. Here are some examples. Again, uncontested cases that are recognized by the American government. In 1953, radioactive iodine was injected into newborns and pregnant women at Iowa University and also in Nebraska. In 1955, the CIA sprayed whooping cough bacteria off the coast of Tampa. 2 died and dozens fell ill. Also in 1955, the CIA enlisted prostitutes in San Francisco, opened 2 brothels and tested drugs on the clients, then filmed through a one-way mirror. In 1956, the Army released millions of mosquitoes carrying yellow fever and dengue on the towns of Savannah and Avon. There were several deaths and hundreds of people infected. In 1960, in Cincinnati, the Army financed a radiation program on 90 destitute or ill inhabitants of the city's university hospital. Some died after several weeks. In 1966, the Army tested a virus in the New York Metro, then in Chicago. The bacteria was concealed in electric bulbs. The aim was to study the spread of chemical agents on a large scale. For these experiments, the Army or the CIA funded laboratories in the most prestigious universities, Yale, Stanford, Harvard, or Columbia. They all took part. Glorified by the idea of working for the nation's defense, the researchers went crazy.
Dr. Kligman in Philadelphia increases a dosage 468 times, which actually frightened Dow Chemical. They couldn't believe that a respected doctor would do that. In Washington, D.C., you had Walter Freeman, who was a very, very well-known lobotomist who traveled around the country doing lobotomies in his car, and he would use an ice pick. He could do 15 to 20 in a day. It was just incredible what some doctors did, and very few, if any, people in the hospital or the medical community blew the whistle on it. It really was an egregious act, and it showed that the medical community was more interested in protecting its ass than in protecting the test subject and the patients, because a lot of doctors went off the deep end and started doing things that are just inconceivable now.
To express his indignation, Alan Hornblum wrote half a dozen books, a former prison guard at Holmesburg in Pennsylvania. From his first day at work over 40 years ago, he had a horrible shock.
I was stunned to see scores of inmates with their shirts off, strapped and wrapped in bandages and gauze tape. And I couldn't imagine that I was going into an atmosphere that was that violent, because all of the men looked like they had just walked a cell block knife fight.
They explain that it's not because of any violence, but experiments that are carried out there. Alan was the first to denounce this scandal and would lose his job as a result.
It was probably the largest human experimentation factory in America, possibly the world. From 51 until 1974, more people were probably incorporated in more experiments than any other place in the world.
Drugs, viruses, cancerous cells, plutonium, sarin gas, the most toxic products were tested in Holmesburg, but also in dozens of prisons throughout the country. To condemn these experiments, Alan Hornblum found former inmates like Youssef. In 1961, this man was imprisoned for selling marijuana. He was poor, with limited education. He was offered a chance to take part in tests for a dollar a day. Since then, Youssef has had his digestive tract operated on. He has liver and skin problems and can no longer work. His first test was for a bath foam from the company Johnson & Johnson.
They took tape and they stuck it on your back and pulled it off, stuck it on and pulled it off until the first layer of skin came off your back. And they put six sections on my back like that. And then they took a bottle with the Johnson & Johnson bubble bath in it and put it on a patch and put the patch over the raw area. Then they took a can. I recognized that can as being from the Army. And I was like, what Johnson got to do with this? So he took the can and he sprayed it on my back. And when it hit my back, it was cold. But it was so toxic, and like fumes, I could taste it in my mouth. And as I'm walking down, I'm getting dizzier and dizzier, dizzier and dizzier. By the time I stepped into my cell, I passed out. Boom, and my back was inflamed. And by the time I woke up that morning, I had great big blisters on my back full of pus. This rash just gets worse and worse. And it looks like when the moon come out at night, it flames up. And I'd be moaning and crying. My cell partners couldn't sleep. Goes over there, a little shot cup, and it looked like water. We drinks it. Everything became magnified. The sound, like the loudspeaker on the system, woo, woo, woo. The walls looked like they turned into water. You know what I mean? And like I spent the whole time like looking around like this here instead of doing the test. So I go back to the block in that condition, and man, I mean, I was tripping, and it was like a slow acting drug that was in that cup. It lasts for weeks. The inmates start naming me out of limits. I had no conversation for nobody. I was scared of the inmates, and the inmates act like they was afraid of me.
What you had were hundreds and hundreds of uneducated minorities, overwhelmingly black and Puerto Rican, and then you had white doctors with white lab coats with PhD or MD after their name, and it was a recipe for abuse, if not disaster. And those prison walls are an ideal spot to do controversial experiments, because just as those walls keep the inmates in, they also keep the public out, so no one finds out about it.
Prisoners were used, but also patients. In certain hospitals, patients were steered towards the services financed by the CIA. These services carried out limitless experiments on psychological manipulation. In 1965, Karen Wetmore was only 13 when she was admitted to a hospital in Vermont. She stayed there several times in her childhood. She suffered from severe depression after falling victim to a pedophile neighbor. Admitted against her will, she was not allowed any contact with her family, being told that it was for her own good.
The CIA was specifically looking for children between the ages of 13 and 18 to further dissociate. They wanted dissociative children. There's a sense of absolute and total helplessness. You're there, you're bound up, you're locked in this room. No matter how you scream, no matter what you say, no one is gonna come. It does something to you, something you don't get over.
The doctors went to work on Karen. They wanted to erase her memory and create a robot at their command. It took 30 years of legal battles for Karen to obtain her medical records and discover the violence of the treatments she was subjected to.
It says seclusion, full cam. A cam is a straitjacket. And ties, which means they tied my arms and they tied my feet. This goes on uninterrupted, day after day, week after week, February, March, April, right up until June 21st, 1971. You sleep on the floor. On the floor, no blanket, no nothing. And my arms were secured like this, behind my back. I do remember that. It's extremely painful because it pulls on your neck, pulls on your shoulder. You can't get away from it. It's maddening is what it is, maddening. And I was naked. And I think that was part of the effort of that experiment to break me down. Everything they did was to break me down.
Months in a confined room with no bearings, while her captors administered all kinds of drugs and sometimes electric shocks at inhuman levels.
Number of shocks and the seconds that they held the shocks. They had 30, 30, 35, 35, 35, and they held it for sustained for 40 seconds. A normal shock would be a second. Certainly not 30 and 35 of them. One, not that many, which probably is what obliterated my memory right there. And I think that's why they did it. They also said, in this treatment right here, no seizure, shock restarted. So they gave me a second one because they couldn't produce a seizure. So they must have done it over again. Must have repeated that. It's unforgivable. And I'm sure I wasn't the only one they did this to. I'm sure. I survived to be able to talk about it.
How many suffered similar experiments? In Montreal, Canada, the CIA used a world-renowned psychiatrist to set up a factory of guinea pigs in the Allen Memorial Psychiatric Department in McGill University. This psychiatrist was Ewan Cameron, one of the all-powerful presidents.